I would now like to introduce our moderator, Mike Myers, HEICE CEO.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to this year's conference. Once again, virtual. It would be nice to see all of your faces as we have in the past. We hope that as things progress, we'll be able to get out in front of you all in the years to come. But again, we're excited about being here. We've got a great agenda in front of us. But before we get started with our agenda, I wanted to just share some things with you that have occurred over this past year, provide a little history, talk about the new things that are happening at ICE and the future of ICE as we move forward. So let's share a little bit about the history. As many of you know, ICE was formed in 1998 as a California not-for-profit mutual benefit corp. And the organization was stood up to address the change or the transition from Medicare risk to Medicare Plus Choice. Over the years, we've had several milestones that have occurred. And one of the other important parts about ICE and ICE's success over the years has been our partners. And our partners are a key component of the success of our organization. ICE meets regularly with associations, and we coordinate our efforts so that we're focused on the delivery of the implementation of regulatory changes and standardization, and our partners focus primarily on the policy aspect. We keep each other updated as our work continues through the year, and we've had great success working with California Hospital Association, IHA, the Integrated Healthcare Association, APG, America's Physician Groups, and the California Association of Health Plans. Quarterly, ICE meets with our agency partners as well. Next slide. Now I want to just take a brief look at this past year and some of the accomplishments, the key initiatives that have been underway that have been extremely successful, and we're excited about the future of these initiatives. Again, we've had over 20 years of success. To date, California health plan participation is up to 115 organizations. Our California provider organization participation is up to 813. And as always, our foundation is built around the voluntarism of our partners and their associates working with us. We have 19 active teams in place with work groups dedicated to many of these initiatives. And I'd like to just share a little bit about what has happened over the past year with some of these initiatives. I'll start with the Credentialing Shared Audit Program. As you all know, this program made it possible for health plans, with the provider's permission, of course, to share audit results for credentialing with other plans. We kicked this initiative off in 2007. As the board approved funding, we got things started, and over the years, developed a new automated web-based process so that we could implement the ICE Credentialing Audits Network system. That system now is expanded to the Northwest, Mid-Atlantic, Texas, and we are looking at more opportunities today. Our next initiative is the IT Systems Integrity Audit Tool. This program makes it possible for health plans with the delegate's permission to share audit results for IT systems integrity and security with other health plans. The business process documents that were developed included the audit business rules, the evidence grid, which includes disaster recovery, data security at rest or in motion, and HIPAA, not just what's happening at your desk, but the actual IT system HIPAA requirements. So some of the results that we've experienced have been extraordinary. This kicked off in the first quarter of 2021, and today, through August, we have 54 audits that have already occurred, and they continue today. The health plans and delegates are continuing to join the shared audit team, and this includes delegates who have their limited Knox-Keene license. To date, we have 7 health plans that participate and over 100 delegates, and we are in discussions with 9 more plans. Things continue to grow, but the primary issue that we struggle with here is just the expertise that is required to do these audits. In 2022, we're estimated to save over $1.5 million overall by performing these shared audits. So let's look at the future. We have some enhancements that are being developed. We're looking at developing a single corrective action plan format that can be built into our tool. Also a single monitoring process that can be adopted. And this audit is in partnership with the ICE Delegated Entity Audit, our compliance program audit, which we'll talk about. And you can look at the process documents at our website. And we are interested in expanding this, as we've had interest from organizations in Washington and Colorado. It's going to take buy-in, as we all know, and volunteers to get the work done. But we're excited about the opportunity to expand this effort. The next initiative we have underway is in 2021, is the Delegated Entity Compliance Audit Tool. In 2020, we kicked this off, and it was part of the process of our first-tier entity attestation team and its work. And the ICE leadership agreed to build out the Delegated Entity Audit Tool, utilizing the initial work that was created by the first-tier entity attestation audit and its team. The future of this audit tool is exciting. We expect to be launching this in the first quarter of 2022. And the ICE team is actively working on the evidence grid, policies and procedures and business rules, and testing the tool. And the work group plans to kick off in late November, early December, with training of the health plans and delegate entities that will be involved in the audit process. And as we kick this off, the policy team is currently recruiting participating health plans and delegated entities and organizing the information to affiliate them in the database in preparation for the shared audit tool process. The next initiative is our HealthNet IHA Edge project. IHA was selected by HealthNet as an encounter data governance entity to oversee a cross-industry encounter data improvement project for the state of California for the Medi-Cal line of business. We are very excited to be a partner organization with IHA on this project, and we are working through our ICE encounter standardization team to develop data standards through this work stream. This is an exciting project, and we'll hear more about it today in later presentations. The last initiative that has been picked back up in 2021 was the ICE Code of Dover. And that particular project had been dormant for a while. ICE kicked off the Dover in 2016. We kind of repurposed that, pulled together a team, and brought it up to date, and got the information back out to the industry. And then we've reestablished the work group, which is focused on creating a parking lot so that we can move the Dover to the next level. We're identifying categories that we may need to build in and look at as part of the Dover initiative: wound care, telehealth, new technologies, and really focused on trying to expand this into the Medi-Cal line of business. Currently, we're commercial and Medicare Advantage only. Version of the new Dofer with all of the updates was finalized and made available and can be downloaded at the ICE website. So we are looking to expand our group and the participation of this group. And so if there's any interest in this area with individuals with subject matter expertise, we would love for you to get on board and help us get this moving into 2022. Now, I would like to talk about the new ICE. This is a very exciting change for us. In 2020, the decision was made to include health into the original name at ICE. There was a lot of feedback we collected from the industry, industry leadership, our association partners, and the regulators, and pulled together a rebranding of the ICE organization and the ICE name. And a decision was made to have a new logo, and I'm very excited to introduce that to you at today's conference. So here is our, moving from the old logo, here is the new HICE logo, Health Industry Collaboration Effort, the tagline, Simplifying Healthcare Administration. We're excited about this, and with this, we can now, we've updated our website. So you can go to the face page on our website, and you can see how the new logo and the color, the colors of that logo are blended in. And we'll continue to update and rebrand the old ICE under the new brand HICE. And we'll, more to come as this rolls out. We'll be communicating to the industry and make, keeping you up to date with all of the good things that we're doing here. Along with the new brand and the new organization, we have some new board members and officers that have been elected as we look at 2020. What's next? The new structure will continue to evolve after 20-year probationary period as the ICE president. HICE has hired me as CEO, so I'm excited to be taking this new role on. As we look at 2022 and the rebranding of the organization and the continued growth and expansion of these great efforts of our teams and the support of the industry, we are so thankful for our partners that continue to support ICE, the medical groups, IPAs, and health plans and associations that provide the financial support needed to keep ICE moving forward. And we would ask that you would continue, and we are looking to increase that support as new geographic areas and new organizations come on board with ICE. We're focused on expansion and growth opportunities. A lot of work has gotten underway in 2021 that will carry forward in 2022. And we think that there is a lot more to come as we look at things like CalAIM, some of the other healthcare legislation that is coming to fruition. It will be important for us to be at the ready and to make our resources available to help support our industry with standardization. We have a continued focus on our partnerships, IHA, APG, CAP, CHA, and the regulatory relationships that we are privileged to work with are all going to be key for the continued success of ICE as we move forward. Healthcare standardization is a critical part of what we do. A lot of good work has come that have eased the burden on operations that have saved millions of dollars that can go back into our healthcare system and delivering care, quality care to our to the communities that we live in. As part of this new branding and my taking on the role as CEO at HICE, we have new officers for 2022. And I'm pleased to announce that our new chairman of the board and board president will be Christopher McGlone. Christopher is the chief operating officer at Sharp Community Medical Group. Christopher has been a longtime board member and has been key in a lot of the work that we've done over the years. So we're excited about this new role for Christopher. Also, our new secretary and treasurer will be Gina Youngblood. Gina is the director of medical and clinical operations at United Healthcare. And we, again, are excited about this role for Gina. She's been on our board for several years and has been a key contributor to many of the successes we've experienced at ICE. Also, with our new officers, we are adding some new members of the board. So we have two of our board members retiring this year, Yvonne Sonnenberg and Leslie McMains, who we thank so much for all of the wonderful work. And as we wind down this year, again, we'll be looking forward to adding both Angela Arredondo. Angela is the Executive Director of Network Management at Memorial Care Medical Foundation, and Howard Sainer, Vice President of Network Operations and Marketing at NAM California, a part of Optum. Excited about them joining our board and looking for their insight and their support as we move ICE forward. So with all of what we've done this year and everything that we are undertaking and targeting for 2022, the core foundation of our success is our volunteers. It's all of you that participate on these 19 teams and growing that it's so vital to our success. So we are looking for you to continue to be a part of this. And for those of you that haven't participated in the past, please come to the website, look at a team, talk to the folks in your organization, come and be a part of this effort. It is great to work with you. We're excited about the years to come, and we're looking forward to your continued participation as you get involved. Again, thank you for participating in today's conference. We're looking forward to the years ahead and our opportunities to meet with you face to face and enjoy the participation and collaboration that we have in the past. So with that, I would like to move ahead with the rest of our agenda and introduce to you this morning's keynote speaker. This keynote has been a longtime friend of ICE. He has been a keynote speaker at this conference for many, many years, and is always a joy to bring John Gorman to the stage, or today to the computer. So John is the founder of the chairman of Nightingale Partners LLC, a leading healthcare investment advisory firm supporting innovative companies focused on addressing social determinants of health. John is the former founder and former executive chairman of Gorman Health Group. At the time, the industry's leading consulting practice and technology shop, spinning out nearly a dozen entrepreneurial ventures and government health programs. At GHG, John's work focused on Medicare, Medicaid, and the Affordable Care Act strategy, governance, and turnaround of distressed health plans. As I said, John has always been a friend of ICE, and we love to hear the great information that he brings to the conference. So, John, thanks for being here.
Mike, thanks so much, and congratulations on the rebranding to all the new officers and board members. And man, ICE is nice. I like it. And, you know, can't hurt to be a little more specific about the mission that we're all engaged in here. It's a thrill to be back with you guys, as always. This is always my favorite talk of the year. And Mike and the team asked me to give a review of what's going on in social determinants of health and in supplemental benefits in Medicare Advantage and in Medicaid. So for the next 45 minutes or so, I'm going to run down for you guys what we're seeing in the landscape, what we're seeing in terms of benefits and innovations in the social determinants of health ecosystem. And I'm going to lead you through some of the work that we're doing and how we approach it, because while there is a huge arms race going on in Medicare Advantage and in Medicaid around social determinants of health benefits and investments, it really is an arms race that's bifurcated between the big national plans and the smaller local and regional plans in the middle market. Much of the innovation that's going on thus far is really among the likes of United and Humana and Anthem. And our experience in our last 2 years at Nightingale has been that the middle market is really still struggling to figure out how to approach this in a systematic way and with an eye toward the future and these types of benefits being a permanent fixture in our benefit designs. We have a huge tailwind at our back in that President Biden has basically ushered in a golden age of health equity. I mean, this is a whole of government approach everywhere from the COVID task force, which has a chief health equity officer, to I was just on a huge call the other day with EPA, HUD, and the Energy Department, which is engaging in a massive asthma prevention initiative in public housing to try to reduce asthma disparities among particularly kids of color. So, I mean, you're seeing this in every facet of the Biden administration, and this is a huge support to us going forward. You're going to start to see some much more thoughtful initiatives around data collection, around race and ethnicity of members. This is desperately needed, as we're aware that 94% of commercial plans, 50% of Medicare Advantage plans, and as few as 30% of Medicaid plans have any idea about even the basic race or ethnicity of their membership. So there's tremendous work to be done in data collection to get this stuff moving. And then we'll share with you guys some of our process for how we approach this. If you're one of the plans in the middle market that are still trying to figure out how to get moving on this stuff. This is all a critical area of focus and investment because we're all aware at this point that social determinants account for 60 to 80% of what we spend on healthcare in this country. And it's, you know, just a huge portion of what we spend on healthcare in this country is directly attributable to poverty and racism. And if we want to have any hope of bending the cost curve, especially in Medicare, which MedPAC is still projecting is going to run out of money within the next 3 to 4 years. These are critical investments and initiatives that we really need to get very serious about very quickly. These types of interventions reliably yield 3 to 8x return on investment in reduced health costs, in improved quality, and even in revenue improvement by getting to the all-important 4 stars or 4 apples in Medicaid and staying there. I mean, it's really worth pointing out right now that in Medicare Advantage, a plan with 50,000 members, when it hits that all-important 4 star, is looking at a bonus quality bonus payment in the vicinity of $50 million on 50,000 members. So this is big money on the revenue side as well. And I think we're all aware that stars and Apple ratings in Medicaid are all now slanting very heavily toward the member experience. And we all know that duals and other vulnerable members that we serve tend to be the biggest drags on our star ratings, especially in the CAHPS and HOS surveys. So some of the best ways of addressing lagging stars measures is going to be substantial investments in basic social determinants of health. And as I mentioned, addressing poverty is really the best path to bending the cost curve. So I don't want to spend a lot of time with you guys on the history, but I think we're all aware that, you know, this last 5 years has really been a watershed in social determinants of health and benefits and services that we can include in our benefit designs to better meet the needs of vulnerable communities that we're serving. And, you know, the benefit landscape is broad still around what the plans are doing. And I'll get into some details on that in a second. But the guiding principles that we really espouse and that everybody from the Long-Term Care Quality Alliance to NCQA all kind of agree on is that these types of benefits need to be clear and easy to understand, that they're equitable and targeted to those in greatest need, which is often why it doesn't actually make a whole lot of sense to have these types of benefits in your bid for mainstream Medicare Advantage plans, because these are the types of benefits that you want to target just to certain beneficiaries, not necessarily to all of your members, unless, of course, we're talking about a special needs plan. then a special needs plan really does make sense to make these types of benefits and services available to everybody through the SSBCI program or through the primarily health-related benefits program. But for mainstream sort of MA plans, it really does make some sense to think of this stuff as an administrative benefit that you can target to those in greatest need and not to everybody. That these benefits are designed to be manageable and sustainable over the long term, that once you start providing these sorts of benefits and services, generally you do not go back and then not offer them a year or two later, that these become permanent fixtures of your benefit design, because these are some of the stickiest benefits going in terms of member satisfaction and member retention. So making them manageable and sustainable, very importantly, sustainable, as we like to do in the financial arrangements around some of these investments, and I'll show you how we do that, is absolutely critical to be able to maintain these types of benefits and services over the long term. That they evolve with experience and data supporting their effectiveness. This stuff has to be utterly data-driven, not just in your benefit design and how you're doing your scan of your service area to determine what's capacity to offer these types of services, but importantly throughout the offering of them, so that you can evaluate how good a job that they're doing, where improvements need to be made, and tweaks in the benefit, as we'll see in just a minute. And very importantly around compliance. Some of you may have seen earlier this week that CityBlock got hit for potentially a self-referral and a False Claims Act action by the Department of Justice around a transportation benefit to its clinics. So one of the most important features of offering these types of stuff is that they cannot be designed or offered with the intention of inducing members to join or referrals to friends to join. These are not marketing tools. These are health management tools and population health management tools, not marketing and sales tools, as some plans and vendors have tried to do. I don't need to tell you guys about the huge mountain of research that shows that these types of benefits and services yield outsized return on investment. The one that made me want to be a healthcare investor was the incredible experience of Geisinger Health Plan in Pennsylvania, where they found they were spending about $240,000 per member per year on their uncontrolled elderly diabetics. So they started a pilot program for 1,000 of them of a medically appropriate diabetic meal delivery. And within 15 months, they had that average cost down to $48,000 per member per year. So that was a net savings of $192,000 per patient per year. That equated to a 35x return on investment. And man, unless you you bought Bitcoin last May, there is nothing in this world that will get you a 35x return on investment, unless you're talking about addressing the root causes and effects of poverty, racism, and poor health and nutrition among your members. So just by the numbers, we're seeing quite a bit of innovation around these types of benefits, and we're seeing huge growth in them year over year. So this is the supplemental benefits for the chronically ill, or SSBCI. And here we saw, you know, just a 300% increase, 300% increase in food and produce. One of the most interesting innovations that we saw in the last 2 years is the offering of pest control and other home modifications benefits. These are hugely impactful for folks living in poverty, and just a tremendous benefit, especially for those with respiratory conditions. The offering of a pest control benefit is really just a huge innovation. But as you can see, you know, while we're seeing huge increases in the number of plans offering these. We're still at only about 20% of plans participating in any sort of meaningful SSBCI or primarily health-related benefits for programs. These are very small ends that we're talking about here. So while these increases appear huge, it's still a rather pitiful number of plans that are offering SSBCI or, as you see here, the primarily health-related benefits. It's worth pointing out that this year, on average, the plans offered about $22 per member per month on supplemental benefits. And when you consider that, say, something like a broadband internet benefit will cost you around $11 to $15 per member per month, this is really a very small amount of money that the plans are committing to these types of benefits. Now, yes, we did see a 240% increase in SSBCI last year to this year. We saw 111% increase in primarily health-related benefits between last year and next year. We saw a 326% increase in in-home supports. We saw, sadly, a 60% decline in the number of plans offering adult daycare services year over year. We saw home-based palliative care go up 241%, and 96% of the plans that offer a meal benefit are now offering more than 50 meals a year. So in food benefits in particular, we're seeing a big trend away from episode-based meal benefits, like you get discharged from the hospital and we'll have 2 weeks of food waiting for you when you get home, transitioning this more to a permanent regular benefit of a certain number of meals per month or quarter. That is a very welcome development. So, you know, while we're seeing lots of plans get into this, it's still a relatively small number. And what we're seeing is table stakes now in terms of the types of benefits and services that plans are almost expected to offer in order to remain competitive with big nationals. So, you know, the table stakes now are all the ones you see above the red line here. You know, eye exams, eyeglasses, fitness benefits, telehealth, which, you know, rocketed to normalcy among plans during the pandemic, hearing exams and hearing aids, a dental benefit is now being made available to 94% of the plans. Over-the-counter drugs have been hugely valuable, especially during the pandemic, as well as remote access has been. And a meal benefit has now really gone mainstream, with 2/3 of plans offering a regular meal service. What is emerging is some of the stuff that's really important, and we'd really love to see some real acceleration in these types of services, especially non-urgent medical transportation, which is huge. I mean, more than 35% of Medicare beneficiaries are seriously transportation challenged, and just the ability to get to doctor's appointments or to go to a grocery store if you live in a food desert or a pharmacy to pick up your meds is really becoming a critical benefit. And in-home support services, as we saw huge growth there, again, over a 300% increase in in-home supports, but really only among a very small number of plans. So still a lot of room for innovation here and for a lot of growth. Again, so we saw primary health-related benefits up 48% in 2021. 253% increase in SSBCI this year. As you would figure, about twice as many special needs plans offer these types of benefits than mainstream individual Medicare Advantage plans. The fastest growing health-related benefit, as I mentioned, is a 92% increase in in-home benefits and supports, and a social needs benefit in particular. So again, huge growth in percentages, but that's because the ends are still so small. It's only about 20% of the plans that are offering these, and they skew very heavily toward the big nationals and the large special needs plans, especially in Puerto Rico, where most of the SNP membership is. But where they are, they're almost all of them are offering this kind of stuff, and it's critical to do so, especially with dual eligibles and other vulnerable members. Now, for those of us in the middle market that are really behind on this stuff and wondering how to get started in a meaningful way, I wanted to show you guys and sort of open the kimono here a little bit to our process so that maybe this will be helpful to you in really institutionalizing an effort around understanding the membership better, what their needs are, and then designing the interventions appropriately in a data-driven way so that they'll be most impactful and have the greatest return on investment. We are investor-backed, so everything that we do has to be data-driven and has to show a considerable return on investment. We have yet to produce an intervention that got less than a 27% internal rate of return, largely thanks to this process. So first, you got to analyze, and you cannot know your members and their needs well enough. You know, this is really a critical analytics process here. Again, getting back to the just astoundingly bad numbers around race and ethnicity of our members, you got to start there. I mean, you just cannot do anything meaningful in social determinants unless you know who among your membership is Black, Brown, Asian, and then the ethnicities within those races. I mean, the way you design, say, a diabetes intervention for a Haitian American member is dramatically different than what you're going to do for a Russian member. Or a Cambodian member of your plan. So understanding the basics of race and ethnicity is critical, but then you got to go way beyond that. And many of the analytics vendors that are out there are just simply not going deep enough. We are looking at about 5,000 different sources of publicly available data on every one of these interventions on our way in. This is our due diligence process. And so we're looking at things like, who checked into a homeless shelter in the last 2 years? Who checked into a food bank in the last year? Who had a car repossessed or a home foreclosed on? We're looking at CDC and local health department surveillance reports on not just COVID, but you know, on heart and respiratory conditions and on kidney disease as well. So really knowing the membership intimately, block by block and house by house, is how this stuff is done best. And then aggregating up to do your hot spotting so you can see where the areas of greatest need are, and then your ability to drill down to individuals and households so that you can decide whether this is an on-bid benefit we're going to offer to everybody or an administrative off-bid benefit that we're going to target just to these special communities in greatest need and to the members who live there. Now, the environmental scan of the service area is critical, because what you're doing here is looking into your communities, especially your community-based organizations, to see what is the capacity to offer these types of benefits and services at scale to your members. It's worth noting that a lot of area agencies on aging out there, about 50% of them, hold contracts with health plans, but many of them lack capacity to serve many more members. So the critical piece here is really getting to know all of the community-based organizations, the nonprofits, the philanthropic groups, the community-based organizations, the 12 nice church ladies in a basement somewhere that are preparing 100 meals for delivery the next day. Can you get them to prepare 2,000 meals for delivery the next day? That's going to require scale. That's going to require investment and a lot of careful planning around expanding capacity that's sustainable to serve larger and larger groups of people year after year. Then you got to let the data tell you what the intervention design could look like. This is to be highly customized to the membership, especially around population health matrices and what you're seeing in the population. I mean, your care managers know exactly what I'm talking about here. They can probably already tell you off the top of the head what they think is needed to meet the needs of these members. And the design process is really around decisions of on-bid, off-bid, administrative, or in the bid as a SSBCI or primarily health-related benefit, and then how you're actually going to get these services to the members at the ground level, which community-based organizations you're using, which vendors you're going to need to bring in to fill gaps in capacity and scale, and things of that sort. So, and then the design also has to be considered within the lens of revenue and how you're going to make these types of services and benefits sustainable over the long term. In our process, and what brings us to phase four, which is capitalization, generally what we do is a shared savings arrangement with our partner plan or medical group or health system that's at risk. And we will split some of the savings that these types of interventions generate and then reinvest those savings into serving more people the next year. That is critical to the ongoing sustainability of these types of programs. And I think it's really why a lot of the plans are kind of stuck at $22 per member per month that they're spending on this stuff. That's really just sticking your toe in the water kind of level of spending and investment here, because there hasn't been enough consideration given to how do we determine return on investment? How do we count that with our actuaries so that we know we can attribute savings to these interventions and then basically squirrel away some of those savings to invest in these programs for the next year to serve more people. Shared savings arrangements are awesome in the context of value-based care, but as we're seeing with Medicare ACOs and elsewhere, the thing that defines a shared savings arrangement is diminishing returns. I mean, you house a homeless guy that costs you $120,000 this year because he's bouncing in and out of the ER. Well, now once you've got him in stable housing, now he only costs you $30,000 this year. That's a one-time savings of $90,000. That means you got to serve another homeless guy next year to perpetually generate enough shared savings to sustain the program over the long term. We make these investments on a 7 to 10 year investment window, at which point these things are all self-sufficient. And then finally, it's all about the implementation and, you know, getting this stuff out on the street, launching it, and then continuously evaluating the effectiveness of these programs as you move forward. The diligence and the analytics that we do in that very first step of the process is really about developing a social profile down to the individual member level. So this is where you combine all your claims data, all your pharmacy data, all your lab and radiology data, all your customer service data, and then all the social data that I was talking about earlier to get a social profile of the member, which you then aggregate up to populations and communities. In phase two, in your scan, this is all about helping you hotspot where you're seeing your members in greatest need. Most of us know where those folks live off the top of our head, because just driving through them, you can see the desperation and the poverty and the need in some of these communities. But this is where the data tells you exactly block by block where the membership and where the need is. And then this enables you to go into those communities to do the scan and the assessment of the community-based organizations that will help you with the capacity in meeting that need that you've identified. Then when you're getting into design, it's really looking at what are you know, the dominant populations that popped up in your analysis. In almost everything we do, diabetes is right there. Diabetes is the epidemic overlaid on the pandemic. And it has gotten decidedly worse in the last 2 years, especially among people of color. Almost every single intervention we're doing has a major diabetes component to it. And in Medicaid, it does as well, especially around all the state Medicaid RFPs around maternal and child health. I mean, the biggest part of the reason you're seeing huge disparities in maternal and child health among Black and brown women is because of diabetes. And gestational diabetes results in all kinds of hazards to the baby. And then for that whole intervening first year of their lives is a huge risk of just from diabetes among pregnant women. So that one's huge. But another example is, you know, we got a huge surprise recently on a project up in Oregon where we were looking with a big medical group up there at what the need was. And surprisingly, we found in the data that the vast majority of their seniors were spending more than 50% of their income on rent or mortgages, and that 60% of those members said that their housing quality was very poor and that they could not afford to make the necessary home improvements to reduce physical risks, and especially fall hazards. And we found that among their membership, they had the highest rate of falls anywhere we'd ever seen. So we ended up, to our surprise, having to design a fall prevention initiative that was everything around home modifications, you know, ramps and bumpers and railings, but then also medication reviews, because one of the biggest contributors to falls among seniors is over medication or medications interacting poorly that makes them confused or wobbly and they fall a lot. So with a multifaceted intervention around reducing fall risks, the results that we're seeing on that one are just staggering, because every one of those falls resulted in an ER admission and very often in a hip replacement surgery that was, you know, on the magnitude of $40,000 to $70,000 per admission. So that one paid for itself by a 5x ratio so far. And again, it never would have occurred to us to have done that had we not really done an exhaustive diligence process at the front end to see where the needs were. Now, in funding these things, this is where you have to be very thoughtful with your actuaries in particular around whether we're going to do this on benefit or off benefit. Again, if you make it on benefit and you put it in the bid, you got to offer it to everybody. And that presents some interesting challenges for mainstream Medicare Advantage plans or group Medicare Advantage plans, as opposed to special needs plans, especially dual SNPs, that generally have the same needs among the membership, among all of them. So in many cases, and that's why you see the higher numbers among SNPs, it makes a lot of sense to make these types of services available to everybody. But in a mainstream plan, you know, very often it makes a lot more sense to do rifle shots instead of carpet bombing with these types of services. I mean, home modifications are very expensive. I mean, in a lot of the home mods we were doing in Oregon, they averaged about $5,000 per member. But again, we were saving $40,000 to $70,000 for most of them per annum. And so that was, you know, that was a huge return on investment there. But really making sure that you're targeting these types of services to the folks in greatest need is critical. Now, if it's on benefit, you're putting it in the bid and it's paid for by the plan. If it's off benefit or an administrative, that is either paid by the plan or from external financing. That could be a third party like us. That could be the federal government, like some of this infrastructure money that's coming out, or say the FCC's emergency broadband program, which takes $100 off a cable bill every month and makes devices like smartphones and tablets available for free to low-income people. or to state government programs, depending on the state that you're in. California, for instance, where many of you are from, is very progressive around this stuff. CalAIM and other state programs can contribute capital here, like new market tax credits. If you're doing a place-based investment like an adult daycare center or a diabetes education center or a birthing center, if you're a Medicaid plan, and state governments very often will provide cheap capital or debt or equity to help defray some of the costs of standing these types of programs and infrastructure up. If it's in SSBCI, that's usually paid for by the plan through the bid. And that external financing, you know, that requires, you know, one of the things that we really see lacking among plans in the middle market is a business development capability that, you know, you basically have a guy on your team who works kind of like a banker. And, you know, they know how to scan for funds that are available. They know how to go out and raise money from investors. They know how to structure deals. You need look no further than a guy like Benoit Bonsali at Scan Health Plan in Long Beach, who's basically their chief development officer. And look at what Benoit rolled out this week. I mean, he just started there 3 months ago. They've already made four major investments at Scan because a guy like Benoit comes from the finance world. He knows how to structure and get deals done. And that's very important as you're putting together the long-term infrastructure you're going to need to make these benefits and services sustainable over the long term. Now, back to data and the sources of data that you have available to you. Now, I know, especially among plans in the middle market, that a lot of this stuff is just a mess. And the heavy lift here is really just getting this type, these types of data in some sort of intelligible format so it's not just noise. But you've got claims, you've got health risk assessments, you've got electronic health records, you've got screenings that come out of, say, behavioral health interventions or the annual wellness visit. You've got critical intelligence that you get from your member service calls and from the case notes of your caseworkers and social workers. But then, you know, you've got to be looking well beyond the data that you have at your fingertips within your own organization. You got to be going to your providers to collect this stuff, like school health centers, if you're in Medicaid, are treasure troves of information on what's going on with kids where they spend most of their time at school. Collecting Z codes, if they're using them among your medical groups that are starting to code for this stuff, is extremely helpful. Again, this is where collecting basic race and ethnicity data from the membership. We have multiple touch points with members. I mean, they're, you know, the member service teams are touching members on average 8 to 12 times per year. These folks are incurring 26 visits in the outpatient setting on average every year. A very simple race and ethnicity questionnaire while you're talking to them helps solve this problem in a very big way and very quickly once you focus your attention on getting it done. Then you got to go to some of your external sources like data vendors, like a Clarify Health or a Socially Determined, and then from the community-based organizations. I mean, sophisticated community groups like a Meals on Wheels or a Catholic Charities or a Lutheran Services, these guys have some pretty amazing data at their fingertips from the years in which they've been engaged with these communities. And getting your hands on that data through cooperative agreements gives you a much more robust portrait of what's going on with the membership. Community health assessments, and then, you know, again, like we do, looking at government data, not just from CDC or local health departments, but the Bureau of Labor Statistics, for instance, is great around specific unemployment features and, you know, in California, tracking everybody, including migrant health worker, farm workers. And then the stuff that you get directly from the consumer, as I mentioned earlier, really using that annual wellness visit. Almost every contact the member service team meets, even from brokers and caseworkers or social workers that you've got out in the field, that stuff is gold from the standpoint of analytics and from the standpoint of benefit design. Now, then once you've got all the data and you're figuring out what you're going to do with it, what your intervention's going to look like, then you got to turn to structure. Now, in your organization, this may be just as simple as just going out and engaging in contracting with a bunch of community-based organizations and a couple of vendors to get the need met. But for instance, if you're doing this off benefit and you're seeking external third-party capital like ours to help defray the costs of these types of services, then you're going to want to start to think about a new entity that will begin to build the social health infrastructure you're going to need for. Basically, we need to be building a social benefit management structure. So in many cases, we will set up what we call a social MSO. Some of our clients call it a social health innovation center. Some of them call it a social health center of excellence. But it's an external new co to the health plan that external third-party capital can come into, and that serves as the vendor and contracting hub for the organization. You want it separate because it'll be more nimble, more flexible than most health plan bureaucracies will allow for. And interestingly, with a structure like this, many of our clients actually will move some headcount from, say, their care management teams from the health plan over to the social MSO, and that helps reduce some of their administrative overhead. I mean, we've got a lot of plans that are struggling to meet the minimum medical loss ratio, and this is a good way of defraying some administrative expenditures and then moving, say, you know, your diabetes management staff over to, say, the social MSO, and then you take them off your headcount at the health plan, and you're having external investors basically now supporting them as part of this social infrastructure. You then contract downstream with your vendors, with your community-based organizations, and this is where you make investments in those downstream entities, because if you're going to be engaging these folks long-term, in effect permanently going forward, it doesn't hurt to like invest some of your own capital in them, because look, as your own vendors, you're going to be fueling a lot of their growth. I mean, we really only advance our own portfolio companies in a lot of the interventions that we do, because that's just smart business for us, as it would be for a plan pursuing a structure like this. So a social MSO that's designed as an independent vehicle can be wholly owned, but you know, a third party instrument that's going to exist outside the health plan's bureaucracy, it'll be nimble, it'll be quick, it serves as the investment vehicle and provides centralized administration for all social benefits for the plan going forward. And so I hope that that's a clear and easy to understand way of how to approach this. Now, in designing, say, a particular intervention, then what we're looking at is a process here where, you know, you're using all of the data that we described earlier in the due diligence process. So let's say we identified members with diabetes in our Medicare Advantage plan. These folks have limited healthy food options. They live in food deserts. They have really poor transportation security. There's little public transportation that's available and just not a lot of options for them. There's a lot of housing instability. These folks are struggling to make rent. And with the eviction moratorium poised to expire when the COVID public health emergency is finally lifted, hopefully sometime next year, we're looking at 2 to 5 million people that could be rendered homeless instantly when that happens. So you're going to see a lot of housing instability as you dig into this stuff, and huge issues in basic literacy, but more importantly in health and digital literacy as well. So let's say we're going to intervene on behalf of 5,000 of these diabetics. And these are some of the assumptions that we have going in. And so the data tells us that we should offer a diabetes prevention program, introduce some healthy food resources, expand peer-based health education and diabetes training, some help around the affordability of medication, especially insulin. Guys, I got to tell you, if you're still struggling with how to get started in social determinants, first start with copayments and deductibles. Copays and deductibles are just economic barriers to access. It makes absolutely zero sense that any of us are charging a copayment for insulin. It's a life-saving drug. We need these people to take it so that they avoid frequent hospitalizations and worse. I mean, we're seeing an epidemic of diabetic amputations right now among Black and Brown people because insulin, the price of insulin has gone up 1,100% in the last decade. And then laying on a copayment, even if it's a $5 copay, that can be more than a lot of these poor folks with diabetes can sustain. And so they, you know, they'll take a half a dose of insulin or they'll skip a month, and that's a disaster. So really looking at medication assistance for life-saving drugs like insulin is absolutely a critical part of any intervention. Wrap around transport so that they can get to their appointments and to, say, a grocery store so that they can eat better. And then weave broadband and internet access into these interventions because, guys, we have found in the last year in particular, more than 50% of duals especially lack adequate internet access. Or if they have it, they don't have a smartphone, they only have a flip phone, and they can't participate in any kind of complex care management, remote monitoring, or any of the apps that we would need to get them on a path to better health. So weaving broadband into this, and I'm going to show you some numbers right here that are going to blow your hair back. So this is an actual model of one of the programs that we did in this last year. And one of the things that I want you to notice in the assumptions is in this middle column right here, where we did a control group and an experiment group around broadband internet access. Of the 5,000 folks that we are intervening with, we are about 750 of them have diabetes, and then we've got about another 1,000 that are pre-diabetic and with rising risk. So our target population ends up being about 35% of them, or about 1,750 people. Now, here's where it gets really interesting. In the control group with no broadband, we ended up reaching about 50% of those folks. But when we offered a broadband internet benefit and provided them with devices, we reached 75% of folks in the experiment group and reached 85% of them. And we got, as you can imagine, an engagement rate that was almost, that was well more than double the engagement rates of those folks without broadband. And the number of folks that we got to completion of the program was more than double what we saw in the control group. So this absolutely answered for us definitively that broadband is totally worth doing. I mean, with another client we did a broadband intervention with in Medicaid, we got a 2,400% increase in engagement in the folks that we provided the service to. And again, it costs about $11 to $15 per member per month to offer a broadband benefit. This is especially impactful in the Medicaid population, because then it's helpful for the kids if they're still doing remote learning. And they're not sitting on a curb outside a 7-Eleven and backpacking on their Wi-Fi there. But what you see here is the cost breakdown of the program. So we dropped about $500,000 into this pilot program. It resulted in a net savings of $2.5 million. Or a 5x return on investment in year one. Usually diabetes interventions take 2 to 3 years to start to show these kinds of results. This is what we got in the first year, and that's a 5x investment. We expect that that's going to double next year as we make the broadband benefit available to everybody who needs it, and we have that higher proportion of folks that we're finding, reaching, engaging, and completing as a result. So I hope this is, you know, a helpful sort of quick study in how you develop the program, how you build the financials around the program, how you calculate ROI. I mean, we only got into straight savings from a baseline in year one, and then at the end of year one. But what also needs to be in here is revenue improvement from stars, from better coding for risk adjustment that results from these types of programs, et cetera. Broadband is interesting because it generates revenue for the plan. I mean, you're getting landlords to pay you to put up small, medium range towers and Wi-Fi hotspots. There's actually some revenue that comes out of offering a broadband benefit to your members. So that hasn't even been factored in here. And when it is, you see an even higher return on investment from these types of programs. So measuring success of these things is critical. I mean, you just don't want to be doing this stuff in a vacuum. You have to be able to show you're getting concrete results, not just in member engagement, but in better quality of care and outcomes, and then in a financial return. I mean, to be blunt, health plans just are not going to invest money unless there's a very clear and ongoing sustainable return on investment that will result in this stuff. I mean, you know, it's no secret why they're only spending $22 per member per month on average now on this stuff, because a lot of actuaries and executives still consider this stuff to be experimental. They're, you know, they'll say we're just big bill payers. What do we have to be a social service agency for? It's because this stuff is going to bend the curve on our medical loss ratio, and we're going to prove it to you if you have the right metrics and KPIs in place to be able to track the financial return on investment as well. And again, it's not just cost. You got to be looking at the revenue side of this equation as well, because ultimately all of this stuff accrues to stars as you go forward. These types of services are the stickiest, most loved types of benefits that you can offer your members. I mean, once you provide somebody internet access in this day and age, they rarely leave you thereafter. We get a lot of questions around compliance. And as HEIS is, you know, largely focused around compliance initiatives, and that's been a big part of our mission for the last 20 years. If you're offering this stuff on benefit that's in the bid, these types of benefits have to be offered uniformly and consistently and without cost sharing. Obviously, you're offering this stuff to poor folks. You don't want to put up an economic barrier to access like a copayment or a deductible for it. If it's off benefit and an administrative benefit, that eligibility has to be very clearly defined and documented and absolutely uniformly applied to established members. Not prospective members, established members without cost sharing. This is where CityBlock got in trouble, because they were offering a transportation benefit to not just existing patients, but to prospective patients, and they were using them for referrals as well, it appears. That's where you get in trouble. There can't be any cost shifting to CMS, to members, or to other third-party entities. These benefits can't be used as inducements to join a plan or to generate referrals. You can't have, you know, brokers can obviously be out there talking about these as benefits that are available as part of the plan, but you can't, you know, go out to beneficiaries that are sitting in an adult daycare center and say, hey, you know, we can provide you with 5 rides a month and 30 meals a month if you join our plan, and you're doing that outside of normal channels. That's just not cool. And be aware that there is actually a 4-year-old safe harbor in place around transportation services that allows you to do this stuff if you design it right, without fear of anything around the self-referral ban or the anti-kickback statute. So some important considerations there. Always have compliance at the table when you're putting these types of programs together. So, Mike, with that, I wanted to leave us some time for some questions, and I'll throw it back to you, my friend.
Thank you, John.
My pleasure.
So we'll go ahead and take any questions.
Okay, so we have one question in the questions pane that I will read for you. And this is from Mary Curry from Torrance Memorial IPA, who asks, can you comment on where we have failed in the past in social health benefits?
Well, I think the only failure is that we're not doing them more regularly, more robustly. I mean, again, only 20% of Medicare Advantage plans engaging this stuff 5 years after we were authorized to do so is a pretty disappointing result so far. I don't think there's, you know, a wrong way to do this stuff. It's just you got to get started, and you got to do it very thoughtfully and meaningfully. This stuff is hard work. And I think the reason a lot of it is lagging is, one, there's still a lot of, look, you, let's be clear about something. CEOs don't run health plans. Actuaries run health plans. And actuaries have to be on board with the structured design and financing of these types of benefits for you guys to get anywhere. So I think what we've seen thus far, Mary, is plans really engaging in this stuff has been more oriented around public relations and marketing and community benefit, and not for specific health impact benefits. And I think that's we're seeing that change. It's just a slower pace of change than I had hoped and many others had hoped. So I think it's really just get out there and start doing it and do more of it. Because right now, especially in what's going to be year three of this pandemic, I mean, we are absolutely seeing the front edge of surge four right now. There's never been a greater need for these types of equitable benefits and services than right now. And I think the plans and their capitated providers have to rise to the occasion and get this stuff done now.
John, just a follow-up to that. So as you alluded to a couple of times during your presentation, there's a lot involved. And as you just stated in answering the question, you know, folks need to get out, challenge themselves, and get their arms around these kinds of benefits.
Yeah.
Is there, within your organization, is there help with kind of kicking this off and getting the data and looking at what the plans have to offer and supporting that initiative?
Yeah. I mean, I think this is really the reason, Mike, you're seeing one of the fastest growing hires is a chief health equity and inclusion officer. This stuff just never moves the way that we need it to if people are doing this off the side of their desks. You have to have a dedicated team that's really focused on doing this and only this. And the head of that team has to absolutely be, this is all they do. It's much like, you know, years ago when star ratings came out, you know, I was out there banging the desk saying, you need a STARS R. You can't do this stuff off the side of your desk. Well, this is the new STARS in terms of where we have to go in terms of something innovative and different than we've been doing it before. And we're just not going to get anywhere unless you've got people that are doing just this and vendors that are doing just this and, you know, active, regularly meeting work groups with not just plan staff, but provider staff and with the folks from the community-based organizations as well. This is hard work, but you can't get there if you don't have people that are committed to doing this and only this. And that's, you know, that's the first step to take.
Other questions?
I mean, really seeing this is like embryonic still among the HICE members, Mike, outside of the big national plans, that the plans are still relatively behind on this stuff?
Not a lot of hard data, John, in that regard, but I can tell you just as we look around our membership and I think there's a lot of interest, and that kind of where my question came from. But it's where's the expertise, as you talked about the czars in this area and not doing this, at the side of your desk. There's not a lot of expertise as folks are just beginning to look at this. And so, I think you're right on relative to bending the cost curve. This is really where the costs reside. And I think if we can figure out a way to get our arms around this and get folks involved and start providing these kinds of benefits and services to our communities, we will see the realities of that bend. So this is great information.
Yeah, thank you. This is real leadership, real focus, real commitment of resources, and if you're going to get anywhere.
Yep, absolutely.
Okay, so the next question, we got another question. This is from Hector Garcia with Inland Empire Health Plan, who asks, does the broadband $11 per member include the device as well, or just the internet service?
No, it does include the device as well. The way that we do it, Hector, is that we wrap around the FCC's emergency broadband benefit that Biden started in the first COVID relief bill. This was billions of dollars to FCC that, as I mentioned, takes $100 off a cable bill every month and then gives you access to free devices and digital literacy education on how to use those devices once you have them. And then we'll wrap around that and then provide augmented services or infrastructure cost in order to make the benefit real. There are huge swaths of this country that have been redlined out of adequate internet access when Trump got rid of the net neutrality rules at the FCC. And it's going to be a while before Biden can reinstate those. And so you have these huge underserved communities that have been redlined out of adequate internet access. And guess what? That's where all the duals and all the low-income Medicare beneficiaries live. And so this one is critical, especially when everybody's still stuck at home. And, we're now heading into the fourth surge. We're going to lockdowns again. Being able to connect with the outside world, not just with adequate access and having enough data monthly to be able to participate in complex health management programs or remote monitoring if you've got COPD or asthma and having a device in your house that's monitoring your breathing and your air quality, you got to have a tablet or a smartphone in order to do that. And you have to actually know how to use it. I mean, we found that, when I was mentioning the 2,400% increase we got in engagement when we did that benefit with that health system in Philly, the biggest kick came from when we sent a geek squad out to just show the elderly folks how to use the device once they got it. A lot of them had never seen a smartphone before and didn't have the first idea how to go about using it, or first time on an Apple device and had never seen something like it. So they just needed some basic training, somebody to provide them with a device that has those apps downloaded on them already and then shows them how to use it. That was actually the biggest contributor beyond what's providing the service to them for the first time anyway. So I hope that helps, Hector. It's this broadband program at the FCC is a mother load of available resources. And by the way, it just got another huge increase in the infrastructure bill that Joe just signed into law earlier this week. So good tidings there on broadband and other home and community-based services investments that just came out of the infrastructure bill.
Okay, this next question is from Christine Lazotte with Children's Health Plan of California. And Christine asks, says that this is really great information. Is there a way to apply it to commercially covered low-income members / patients? How can that be funded by the plans?
I mean, again, actually, it's a lot easier to do in the commercial world because you don't have to go through all these regulatory hoops like you do in Medicare and Medicaid in the bidding process and all the compliance requirements that go around this kind of stuff. It's the same process. It's really just much less encumbered. So, again, you're analyzing your membership data. You're trying to find out where the need is greatest all the way down to a household level, and then letting the data tell you what the members need. Especially among working poor people in commercial accounts, we see them very actuarially similar to a Medicaid childless adult population. I mean, these are working poor people that look a lot like an exchange or an adult Medicaid member. And so you're going to see a lot of the same health issues and social challenges among them. You're going to see high rates of diabetes. You're going to see higher than normal rates of mental and behavioral health considerations. You're going to see real issues around food security, housing security, and transportation security. And a lot of them having internet access issues as well. I mean, generally, all the challenges that you see in a Medicaid population are going to be reflected in a low-income, working poor commercial population. And the luxury that you have is a whole lot less rules to have to adhere to in meeting their needs. I hope that helps. Let me let my chief canine officer out.
Go ahead, Anthony, we got another one?
Yes, we have a question from Krista Nguyen at HealthNet, who asks, how can we improve on data collection when providers slash organizations are not regulated to provide certain types of data?
Not quite sure what that means, but I mean, look, providers collect a lot of data. I mean, just on the basis of claims. Now, claims are obviously, as we've seen with risk adjustment, a terrible proxy for a medical record. But, you know, basically, if you're having trouble getting even basic claims and patient data out of them, one, you got to collaborate. Two, pay them. I mean, you know, doctors, busy doctors and medical groups aren't going to do anything that's uncompensated at this point. And sometimes you got to lay this into a value-based agreement that says you give us this kind of data and we're going to pay you X for it because it's that important to us. And if that's what it takes to get them out of the blocks, or actually mandating the reporting of certain types of data in all of your contracts, that's where you got to go with it. But this is data that you got to have, or all of the design effort that we've been talking about here is for naught. You're going to be offering benefits and services to people who don't need it. There'll be confusion in the ranks. You're going to be spending money that you didn't really need to spend, and it'll just be a mess. So, you know, it's like Malcolm X said, by whatever means necessary to get the job done.
All right, we've got a pair of questions from Ann Bentz. I'm going to give them to you one at a time. The first one is, thinking about data to use in assessing needs of members, would using suspect HCC slash DX data create inaccuracy?
Well, yeah, if it's suspect, obviously. And guys, boy, we have been seeing rising headlines everywhere about how this administration is clamping down on risk adjustment. So the first motto has got to be complete and accurate risk adjustment coding, not opportunistic coding around upcodes that will get us more money when there isn't, you know, the documentation and the record to justify it. But yeah, I mean, you know, it's the old adage, bullshit in, bullshit out. If you got lousy risk adjustment data going into an SDOH design process, it's going to taint everything. So, you know, again, start with multifaceted approach. Claims are really just a proxy for a medical record and for a direct patient intervention. So this stuff is always best designed off of a direct patient assessment. And very interestingly, CMS released back in May, and I put some stuff up on my LinkedIn feed a couple weeks ago about this, that they're advancing a standardized SDOH questionnaire and data collection parameters for this stuff going forward. And we're starting to see some new draft measures coming out from MCQA, PQA, and the National Quality Foundation around standardization of SDOH data collection. So I'd start there. And really, CMS put a really nice resource out there that got very little attention. And I'd grab that either off of cms.gov or off my LinkedIn feed. I posted on it, I think, about a week and a half ago. And that's a huge development. If you guys can believe it, to date, there has not been one single social metric in any CMS program or demonstration, not one. So of the thousands of quality metrics that have been released by the agency in the last several years, there is not a single one around social determinants. So this is a big development from CMS. And I, Mike, I really hope that HEIS will get directly involved in the uptake and the effort around collecting and reporting social data to CMS under these new guidelines that are coming.
I think where there's opportunity here, John, for standardization, as you mentioned, that's yeah, tremendous opportunity for us.
Yep, agree.
Okay, here comes Ann's second question. Have you seen any issues for home modification for members in apartments / landlord issues?
Oh, yeah. Yes. Obviously, it's a whole lot easier to deal with if the member owns that home. But yeah, generally, when you're talking about home modifications to a rental property, then you do have to get the landlord to approve all of it. Now, having said that, it's an extra step, but the vast majority of landlords are going to welcome a health insurer or other third party making improvements to their property. As long as it's not disruptive to other units or to their own operations, generally, you know, cheapskate slumlords are going to welcome somebody else coming in and doing what they should be doing, like in home modification or in pest control and things like that. So it's an extra step, and you got to, you know, jump through some hoops with these guys, and they're not necessarily the most likable people. I mean, these are, you know, these are like Kushner, you know, slumlord types in a lot of these communities. But generally speaking, they don't fight a lot when you say we want to come in and do some mold removal and do some cockroach mitigation, and then seal up some windows and weatherize the place better for winter. Generally, they'll say, great, when are you coming?
All right, those are all of the – oh, I'm sorry, are you still going?
You know, and I was just going to say, you know, sometimes you can get into some zoning stuff, but we it hasn't been enough to really mention as a major hurdle so far for us anyway.
Okay, those are all the questions that we've received. If you want to wrap up a few minutes early, we can do that.
Great. Well, thank you. And thank you all for having me. I hope this was helpful. And as always, wonderful to see you, and happy holidays to everyone.
John, thank you very much on behalf of HEIS and our presenters, folks. We thank you for joining the session. Thank you, John, for all the good information, as always. Extremely helpful and insightful. I think there's a lot of opportunity ahead in this area to help bend that cost curve. Yep. So thank you for joining the session today, and we'll see you at our next session at 10:20.
Sounds great. HEIS is nice. See you guys.